Hello. Randall might not be ready yet. Do we want to add one more person, or you want to just go with three?
I guess the problem would be who'd we add?
Yeah. Well, there's the ever standard Mike Shea.
Right. We could add him, or we could see if Jeff Greiner was available.
Jeff Greiner. Okay. You want to ping him and see?
Good evening, one and all.
Good evening. How are you?
I am okay.
He probably would only be able to stay a minute or two.
That's okay.
Are you talking about Jeff Greiner?
Yes.
That's two. We are contractually obligated to say his name one more time. Or he is unsubscribing. That is what he told me over Twitter.
Really?
Yeah. So I say we don't mention that name again.
He should be paying
Oh.
us.
Well, I was gonna say, every time you see his name on it's either the THP site or on the tome, it says Jeff Greiner. Greiner
Greener, yes,
is his name.
right.
So you actually say his name twice when you say his name.
Yeah, that's
Nice.
right. Oh,
He said we
so
should make it a drinking game.
that's probably a good idea.
Thaddeus already does that.
Yeah. Well, I already had my bourbon this evening, so I've got my mellow, so.
Oh, nice.
Sweet.
So Mondays is ice cream day for you, and Tuesdays is bourbon.
It ought to be. Actually, today, though, we just had this brutal application testing, and it was just all day, and it was not going as well as I would have liked, and it was just really one of the and I don't usually get stressed out about work. My job isn't that hard. I don't have huge, giant levels of responsibility. They sort of pay me for what I know and not what I do from day to day. So, but there are times, like when you're rolling out a new database type stuff, that it's really stressful. And so it was one of those days where I had to come home and it's like, I'm having bourbon tonight. So it was one of those days.
Nice.
Yeah. So.
Well, I still have a bottle of 1964 Jim Beam for you.
Sweet. We'll be there,
Yeah.
man. We'll be there. I'm looking forward to that. So.
So is Jeff around,
Well,
Tracy?
he said that if he comes on, it would have to be on his laptop with the built-in mic and no headphones. So I just told
Ah,
him he
that kind of
sucks.
sucks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell him we will refuse to say his name for the rest of the episode now.
I still think he should be paying us. If we say it three times, then I want goodies of some kind.
I'd probably pay you in Skittles, which is more than I get.
Oh, well, I thought he
Wait,
paid you. I thought,
yeah,
yeah.
I thought your contract said you got Skittles.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it says it, but I haven't gotten it yet.
Oh,
Oh,
it
you
got
didn't.
lost in the mail,
Lost
right?
in the mail.
Okay. I will gladly pay you to tomorrow for a burger today. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's going on?
Well, there's lots on Twitter.
Yeah, what's
My
been
God, the
so
last couple of days.
my work for the past week and a half has been just, I mean, it's basically kept me away from the computer all day, or if I've been at the computer, I've been having to actively work on it, and so I have to keep Twitter closed because otherwise it's, really bad. So I haven't really been online for like a week and a half now, so I'm sort of actually have the shakes, I think.
A little withdrawal, yeah.
Yeah.
So Tracy, I mean, do you agree with me that there's like been two topics that's really been burning up the airwaves the last couple of days?
Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to stay off Twitter because it's just been, I don't know, hard recently. But I did get up to 3 milliwatts, so I'm happy about that.
Wow,
Sweet.
congratulations. Yeah.
Yeah.
I reached him a 1 milliwatt.
I saw.
I've been flirting with it for the last couple of, oh, about the last week or so, but I go in and I vet my followers, and if it looks like spam and it's definitely not RPG related, I delete them.
Yeah.
And so I kept going down. I was like at 490 something for like a week and a half, and finally tonight, after vetting some, I've got 501. It's like milliwatt.
Awesome.
So,
Sweet.
Awesome.
yeah.
Yeah, when I posted that question about submitting whatever I said, I said I had there's this group and I want to write about it and I'm going to submit it, and who would want to read about that? And then I got like eight spam replies from these random like writers wanted thing, and I'm just
Yeah.
like, what the hell?
Yeah.
God, it's so annoying. And I don't even bother, you know, I'm the type of person, I don't even bother to click the link. I'm not going to dirty my computer by going to some, you know, website that's probably full of spam bots and, you know, so I just have to sit there and do block and spam. Mm-hmm. It's so annoying.
Yeah, like the naked maids from Wisconsin or something that I got.
That was awesome. I actually had to click on that link to see what it was. I totally did. I like totally went through it. It's like, oh, that's a real place.
It was awesome. Funny. It was pretty awesome. Yeah, I think there would have been the two topics. And also, Sam, I just wanted to say real quick, when I said to include pitching it to the website itself, I wasn't saying that it wouldn't be a good Dragon article or anything like that. Just I know that they had said that they try to put more crunchy stuff in the magazine and more fluff stuff or lifestyle stuff.
I didn't take it bad. I guess I sort of didn't respond to you in that way, huh? I understood what you were saying. So my sort of my thing is I'll pitch it to them, and if they don't want it either, I mean, if they said, hey, can we use this for the website, I'd say hell yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say no.
Oh yeah.
and you know, and if that doesn't happen, then it'll go on RPG Musings. So
Sam,
you know, either way,
what thing are we talking about?
Well, in my homebrew world, I have this guild of protectors that it's sort of like, you know, Dragon Magazine has this sort of guilds and whatever it is, guilds, and I can't remember the name of the sort of type of article, but it basically just outlines different like associations in different game worlds.
Oh, sure. Or organizations and stuff like that. Sure.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's sort of what this is. So you know, I've basically got it written up for the most part. It's not, of course, in a polished format or any way, shape, or form, but I decided, you know, I'm going to pitch that because I really like it. I've been developing it over the past 2 or 3 months in my game, in my face-to-face game. So I thought, oh, I'll develop that and I'll pitch it. And, you know, if they like it, great, awesome. And if they don't, that's cool. I'll put it on RPG Musings too. So.
Cool. Yeah.
But so what are these two topics that everybody's
well I think laughs. The first one is, and we've talked about it before, I think, but it certainly has been really up going recently, and that's the length of combat in 4th edition. That's the big
that's still being talked about.
Oh yeah, it's still being talked about. And then the next one, and I think this one is actually the most interesting, and I wish that Angry DM was online more often, at least as far as Skype and stuff like that, because I'd love to talk to him about it. His article that he just put out, I think that was today, that about resource management.
Oh, and the 5-minute rest thing?
Right. And that it was really good. And he takes a hard look at it. I mean, he's not being a dick about it, and he's not tearing down the game, but he's taking a very, very hard look at what resource management is all about in 4E. And it's, you know, maybe I'm a bad guy for agreeing with him, but it's broken. It really is. If you look at a campaign style game, it's broken. If you're looking at an encounter based game, one shots and things like that, it works fine. But I think he's right. I really think he's right from a campaign type perspective or ongoing game perspective. I think it's broken. And he makes some very good points. If you have not read the article, and Sam, you want to post this up on the show notes. Okay. In fact, let me see if I can find it now. I'll throw it in.
Oh, I know what his website is.
Okay. Well, that's fine then. Yeah, throw it up on our because it deserves a good. It's a good read. I hope the folks at Wizards read it because he makes some really, really good points, and he's not a jerk about it. Really, it's a hard look. I mean, it's a very, you know, he doesn't pull any punches. But it's not like whiny, complaining kind of stuff. I mean, it's a very, very good look. He backs up what he says. And not only does he call it out, but at the same time, he offers some solutions, too. And I think that makes it a very well-balanced article.
Yeah, I mean, some of these ideas were what was in, I think, Rob Schwab's article as well. But I think Rob's article didn't expound upon them that much.
And it was pretty brief, yeah. I mean, I read Schwab's article too, and I think they were hitting on the same topics. I think they covered different areas of it, but yeah, you're right. Yeah,
Yeah, because Rob's article talks about the resource management part too a little bit. And I know it's something that I too have been annoyed with for a long time, because it leads you to one type of game for the most part. Mm-hmm. And other types of games are much harder to run in the system because of it. Mm-hmm. But of course, in the DMGs and stuff, they don't really talk about that part as much, and they don't offer an understanding of why these decisions were made. So if you want to try to hack and figure out with it, you have to spend a long time thinking about it, or you're just lost and you're just going to make small willy-nilly changes that, you know, may actually make things worse in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you guys want to outline some of the problems, just so that the people who are listening, if they haven't read the article and they're driving or something, they can understand what we're talking about? we asked Angry DM, and I think he's either not online at the moment or he's unavailable. So,
right.
I don't know. Tracy, do you want to start off? Or do you have anything that comes to mind immediately?
Well, so basically, in this article, he talks about how short rests and other encounter resources, like your encounter powers and action points and stuff, cause parties to want to keep doing to act a certain way. I don't know how else to explain it.
Well, basically, after every encounter, you're refreshed.
Right.
There's no sense of as you encountered or as you adventure during the day that you're getting tired, you're getting worn out. The next monster around the corner could very well wipe you out because you're at the end of your rope, but you've got to push on to the final goal. And,
right. The only thing we have are the healing surges. That mm-hmm. when you run out, as you run out of healing surges, like eventually you're going to run down to zero, mm-hmm. and that would be like your sudden the end of the day thing. So of course groups try to make sure they never run out of healing surges.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I haven't read the article, but I take that back. So I came in, and I when I got to work this morning, I opened Twitter and I saw that someone had retweeted his article link, and so I opened it and I was like, oh, it's one of Angry. So I read the first page and I saw that it was like 5 pages long, and I was like, damn. I was like, damn, I don't have enough time to really sit and read this and digest it, because I'll spend an hour doing that and I don't have that time. So I saved the book. I bookmarked it in my, to read tonight kind of folder, which is what I often do. So that's my disclaimer. I haven't read the article, but I'll tell you from my experience, when I first started running 4th edition, I had this problem for the whole probably first year, maybe even longer. Because, sorry, my dog's being annoying.
that's okay.
Because I didn't really understand the resource management, it's hard to say I didn't understand, because I knew exactly what was going on, but I didn't know the game and the system well enough to actually know how to fix it with my group for the longest time. And so here was the problem, and this is probably what he talks about. It's that I would run these encounters, and so we're playing the game and running these encounters, and then basically I was running short enough sessions that we would do like one encounter per session, not more than two, and two was rare because I try to have a lot of role playing, especially at the beginning, and the group was just starting out and whatnot. So basically every time the session would end with them being able to rest, or, the few times that they weren't able to rest, there was always that question of, who kept track of who used an action point, and,
right.
Who kept track of how many surges they used and all that. And it became this sort of I didn't want to have to worry about that so much that I ended up structuring my sessions mm-hmm. so that I made the encounters hard enough that if they all had full powers and healing surges, it was still going to be challenging. So that's fine, right? That was the solution. And so I did all these solution things. But the problem was that then when I got comfortable enough with the system where I could run a game where they would have more than one encounter in a row, it was too difficult for them. because right. I was still building encounters the same way, assuming they had a full complement of resources, and they didn't.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Two quick things. First, I ran into the exact same problem when I started DMing 4th edition. We had the same issues where people weren't always remembering what they used and everything. And I talked about this today on Twitter, and everybody's like, well, that's what the little checkboxes are on your character sheet. And I was like, no, really? I didn't know that. I'm sorry, guys. I'm really sorry. But, I mean, I have an idea of how to play the game. I love the fact that you want to try to help me, and I'm not trying to put it down, but... It frustrated me so much today.
Well, that's why I say. That's like, why I say I don't want to say I didn't. I don't want to say. I hate to say I didn't understand because I did understand and I knew that too. Because, but that's like the best way to express that sort of thing, right?
So the second thing is just so his article's a little bit about that, but it's more like Randy was saying. The only things. In a day that change, like in between extended rests, are your daily power uses, to some degree your action points, and then your healing surges. Right. Everything else you have fresh each encounter, pretty much, or every other encounter with action points.
Right.
And so the problem is, and this is in some ways this is good because this helps get around that 15-minute. Or a 5-minute workday, depending on who you talk to, where in older editions, they quickly did a couple of things because the wizard only had so many daily spells, and then they decided to try to rest.
Yeah.
So that they get the spells back. So it's great because now everybody has something to do every encounter. You don't have to worry about encounters being radically unbalanced because, for the most part, they have a certain amount of powers available to them, and they always have it. So when you build an encounter, theoretically it should be the same. But the problem is if you don't do the full complement of encounters between extended rests, you never wear them down. And that leads DMs to jack up the difficulty level of each encounter, which in turn can make the encounter seem to go on longer. Whether it actually does or not is irrelevant. Every encounter becomes this, like...
Every encounter becomes this
meat grinder.
It's a centerpiece, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I
want to. Can I interrupt you and then I'll let you finish? Huh? I want to defend the wizard because everybody blames the 5-minute workday on the wizard. But I'll tell you what: if you were a dwarf or a fighter back in the day and you got hit for 10 hit points in an especially tough battle that still only lasted 10 minutes, right? You get hit for 10 hit points. You only have 13 hit points. You got to go rest for a week, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's not just the wizard that caused the 5-minute workday. It's pretty much every class had issues.
Well, it's a combination of the – well, and if you didn't have that issue, you would have parties that, well, the wizard wouldn't do anything until you were sure you were fighting a boss. Mm-hmm. Or the other thing is that they would load up like Christmas trees with wands and all this other stuff so that they would have those to cast so they wouldn't use their big spells either. So you had – and those solutions were both totally inelegant. So you really – they had big problems with those. And I had 3.5 campaign that was like that. The wizards and stuff, the first opportunity of coin they got. Well, let's recharge the wands. Okay, spend 5,000. Now you have a wand of 50 charges,
You know what you just did, Randall? You just gave me the idea for the next major villain in my Gamma World game.
A Christmas tree?
Christmas tree with wands all over. And
Save it for next Christmas time. Yeah, absolutely. The holiday season. Yeah. But no, Tracy's right, and I think that one of the big solutions for me to help with that was that I actually keep track of their healing surges in a file. I use an encounter tool. I think it's the old 4E encounter tool, that initiative tracker, and it keeps track of healing surges and things like that. And so I save that file as a whole party, and I save them. And that way, when I bring it up the next time, it's ready to go, and I know exactly where they're at. And even if it's been a month since we played, and we usually only play once a month, I can tell them right off, this is where you're at. And so I can still keep fair continuity going from a campaign standing. But you're still right. I mean, there's this sense that, and Angry touches on his article, you have this sense of invulnerability. Because you're always going to be, you feel like you're always going to be going fresh into a fight. So there's no attempt at creative solutions. There's none of this. Now, I think Dave Chalker has hinted on some stuff on, and I know I think Mike Shays referenced it as well, is that of having encounters with alternate endings. And I think that's another way to go. I think that's a good – I'm not real elegant at that sometimes. So I'm going to work on trying – that's one of the things that I'm trying to do as a DM is work on better ways to, you know, all the combats don't have to end in total death. You know, there's other things that can happen. Right. And to try to do it in such a way that it doesn't seem abrupt or inelegant or just or caveat emptor or anything like that. So, and those are real those are challenging things to do. I think it just takes practice. And I've been DMing for 30 years, so you know it's no one's is going to pick it up right away. It's it's a skill. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but the other problem is that if you follow the rules as written.
I know you love that expression, right?
I can hear the hair bristling on her back from here, her neck from here. So
you really need to do like 3 to 5 encounters per between extended rests in order to have a prayer of wearing down their resources to the point where they may face death. But that doesn't usually work in my story, in the narrative or story that we're telling. Like, it just seems weird to have that many. And I mean, when we talk about these encounters, they're supposed to be the same level as the PCs. Mm-hmm. And it often doesn't work in my story, the way I happen to tell stories, which means I have to find other solutions too. And like, so even if I tracked all the information, this is what I was trying to say on Twitter earlier today, even if I tracked all the information, even if we were really good about all that resource management stuff, it really still doesn't help because you know what? Unless I tell them, no, that extended rest doesn't count as an extended rest, it doesn't matter. They're still going to get all of their healing surges back before it matters that they may die.
Right. So I actually have a story that happened just in my game last night, and that it's the same thing. So even now I have this issue, even though now it's been like 2.5-3 years that I've been playing. But the party's in this cavern, and they went down this passage last session to try to escape this cavern. It's a whole situation I won't go into, but they go down this cavern and they get in this big fight with some Myconids, and they get their butts kicked. I mean, they don't lose the battle. They eventually prevail and they destroy the mushrooms, but they were hurting really bad, and it's been a while since they've been hurt really bad in a combat like that. And then they ran across some bodies that had no metal at all on them, so they immediately said, oh, there must be a rust monster further down. Well, forget this, we're not going any further down this passage because we just got our butts kicked. And they went back to the main cavern, and they had been camping in that main cavern because it's this sort of pilgrimage place to this ancient civilization that's part of the story that's in the background, right? So it's a safe cavern to camp in. But what happened was they had only been awake for an hour. So they came back and they said, oh, we want to do, you know, we're just going to wait until the next morning until we can do this other thing that was the other option that they had to try to get out of this cavern. And when they slept, they all thought they were going to wake up and be like refreshed the next morning. And I said, no, that doesn't count as a long rest. You had only worked or done anything for an hour, and then, you know, you came back and you know, you didn't sleep very well because your body wasn't ready to really rest, but you forced it, and, you know, you're in this weird cavern and blah, blah, blah. So I gave them their powers back, but I didn't give them their healing surges back. But, you know, that still doesn't solve the problem.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know what to do about that. So maybe I should read Angry's article.
He actually has, and that's what I was going to – unless you just had something to jump in there with, Tracy.
No, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say, he does have a couple solutions. Now, one I agree with, and I think I might implement it in my own campaigns. The second one I'm not as sure about because – and I'll explain that in a minute. But he says, and I quote, place a restriction on how many healing surges a PC can spend outside of encounters. For instance, a PC can only spend 2 healing surges at the end of a short rest, and they cannot take another short rest until they've had another encounter first. I tend to agree with that. That's not a bad limitation. I think it is an artificial one, but no more than any of the rest of the resting rules. So, you know, it doesn't really detract from the game, I think, and I think it would work pretty well. The second one is In order to use their best abilities, the PCs need to build adrenaline or momentum or whatever you want to call it. Mechanically, it works like this. After an extended rest, a player only has access to one daily attack power, the lowest level one. After each encounter, during a short rest, he gains access to the next highest level one. If he has two powers at the same level, he can choose which one becomes available. Players can hoard these powers or use them as they become available. Now, on that one, I'm not sure I agree with that, because if you're running a sandboxy type dungeon where the next room may be an easy encounter or could be an extraordinarily difficult one, I think that penalizes the characters by not having their full gamut of powers available. So I'm not necessarily in agreement with that one, but I like the first solution. And I think keying on healing surges is going to be a way to get around a lot of this and to use ways and things that drain healing surges more often. And at the same time, prevent extended rests. And I don't mean by being a dick about it, but like, for example, and I've heard a lot of people say this, you know, in a dungeon, you're not comfortable. You can't get a rest. You know, even realistically speaking, you can't. Are you holed up in a crowded room right outside a very loud location? Again, not getting any rest, you know? So I think there are ways that you can get around that to keep players from taking advantage of the extended rest. So, but anyway, that's my take. At least on that part of it, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the dungeon extended rest thing. And as a rule, I don't. If they're in an extremely dangerous place, they're not taking a long rest. You know, they may want to, and they may say, "Okay, well, we're going to pitch camp and set a watch." Okay, fine, but you're still not going to actually have a restful sleep. But that doesn't work as well in a lot of different situations, because I don't. You know, my parties don't travel exclusively underground or in dungeons, you know. In fact, that's actually the rarity. So normally, you know, they're either in a town doing an urban style, you know, encounter or urban style campaign arc, or they're, you know, in the wilderness, which, you know, you could say the same thing about a forest. You're not going to have, you know, set up camp in the middle of the forest and have great sleep, but it's still not, you know, It's just a difficult. It's another thing to manage.
Yeah.
Right. At this point, I think it should become, you know, you just talk to your table and say, "Listen, I'm gonna have, because of these problems," and you can lay them out for them if they care. Mm-hmm. Say, "I'm gonna control when the extended rest happens." And I mean, when I read the OD&E book for when we did Fellowship of the Tweet, it said that you recovered it after, you know, sleep, unless, or if, as long as your DM agreed with it, when with the cleric's power spells. Like, I didn't necessarily automatically gain them when I woke up every morning and did my prayers. Like, the DM still had the ability to say, "No, you know what? You didn't get them. I'm sorry." And that's because if we had done hardly anything the day before, it didn't make sense to necessarily automatically recharge them. Or it might not make sense. So, I think at that point. And that's why I don't like. That's one of the reasons I don't like Raw, but
that goes back to that poll that's on.
Yeah.
What is it? Mike Merle's article about. Yeah. It's about cover, but it's basically asking: would you rather the DM have the say, or would you rather have an actual rule for everything? And this is sort of one of the. So for me, this is what made 3.5 really difficult to get into, having not played for a while, in that it was like there's a rule for everything. And since there's a rule for everything, you know, it's really tough to break into a system that has, you know, 30 rule books.
Right.
You know, and so right now I'm making a really good case for the essentials line inadvertently, but that's basically I think what the issue was, you know, that they released essentials when they had 36 hardbound books published already, and a new player coming in is going to have a really difficult time if they feel like they should be playing rules as written, because every single one of those books has rules in it.
Right. And that's the thing, is I feel like I feel this way about a lot of programming stuff too, that there should be a very small core that is like what the game is or what the product is. And then there are optional toolkits that you can put on to help you play the particular game you want to play. Because you know what, the rules about extended rests, and short rests even, make sense in a dungeon campaign, where they might not make as much sense in the type of urban or city campaigns that I tend to run. Mm-hmm. Because, you know what, you're probably not going to get into three to five fights unless you're in a hostile city mm-hmm. before the town guards come and right. Start asking questions. And that becomes really hard. And, you know, and it's not what my players want. Like, they want combats every night, but they don't want to go into a dungeon. Like, this was one of the things that they asked when I became the DM was, hey, you know, we'd played Keep on the Shadowfell, and they're like, we really just don't like this dungeon stuff. Can we do something different?
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and I think that, you have to go into a house rule kind of a mode, particularly like in a city adventure like that, because, or like rule, for example, you know, you may have spent most of the afternoon in jail before you escaped. It wasn't really an encounter, but it was pretty stressful. So, you know, you're tired. You're not going to get a lot of rest. You know, the bed you're sleeping in is filled with rats or whatever, you know, or rat dung or whatever, you know. So it's just, you know, I think there's that's the kind of thing that has to happen. And I know that I think in the future I'll have to start playing with some things and mixing and matching. For example, maybe you get your hit points back, but you do not get your healing surges back. You know, or maybe you make an endurance check at the difficult level, at your level, to see if you get your healing surges back.
Right.
You know, to sort of give that sense that, you know, the longer we do this without finding a safe haven, a real safe haven, then the more dangerous it's going to become. And the more resources they lose. I think there's ways around this issue. I think it's just, but I think that as it's, like you said, as it's written, it's a little cracked. It's a little broken. Now you can get into all kinds of hyperbole about, well, it's designed specifically that way. Maybe Wizards is moving to an encounter. Maybe they're assuming that since this is the bulk of the, how they want their new players to play with the encounters programs, things like that, a lot of one shots, not a lot of ongoing campaigns or as many. Maybe that was specifically designed that way. Angry doesn't really say that in his article, so you know I'm not. That's my take. I think that there may be that going on. I don't know. I've never spoken really to any of them personally, so I couldn't tell you if that was on their minds. But it makes you wonder because of the way it is. Yeah.
Well, I think they tried to design a game that hit approximately, let's say, 50-80% of games, and figured that the people who, you know, played the other games that didn't fit the typical mold would do what people have always done in D&D, which is, you know, create their own rules to get what they want out of it.
You're totally right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think you're right.
The other interesting thing that came out of this, I don't know if you saw, I think his name, Owen Stevens? Was talking about how maybe the older systems, how when you came in or what rules system you played by influences how you see things, because of Mike Merle's article today. I don't know if you guys saw that.
I read part of it. Talking about the miniatures?
Yeah, talking about the miniatures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then in particular talking about how the rules changed from 3.0 to 3.5 when it came to cover.
Mm-hmm.
With 3.0 saying basically DM with some guidelines ruled about whether or not a creature had cover and how much cover it had. And then in 3.5, it became something that the players kind of knew more. And
well, it used it sort of used how 4E is, where you count, you go from corner to corner.
Right.
And you figure out, yeah. So it was a more written down, here's, it's not a guideline, this is the actual rule for determining.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and so then one of the other comments that came out of that was looking at the different styles of play, like DM as foe versus DM as facilitator, and I forget what the third one was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you need a more robust rule system that is meant to be run as written if you have a situation where you have more of a competition with the DM. Because if players feel more comfortable if they know what's going to happen. Like, you know what? I don't care what you say, DM. Rules say I have cover. Doesn't matter that, you know, it's only one small little branch. I have cover.
Mm-hmm. And that's totally up to the table, too. I mean, with my players, I don't want to take responsibility for making all those minor decisions, so I actually like to have a lot of rules laid out because my players can say, oh, wait, and I don't mind them saying that because we all know each other, and so we're not getting in each other's – we're sort of collaboratively remembering the rules, if that makes sense, and right. so we don't walk all over each other with it. In fact, I'll have players say, you just totally screwed us. If they look at another, and they'll look at another player, not me, not the DM. They'll look at another player and say, thanks, you just screwed us. Yeah. And so, you know, we call it a BF, and I won't abbreviate that here, but, but yeah. And it's, so it's like, dude, but, so you have to, so I kind of like to have fairly specific rules for tabletop management because that way I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to come up with a judgment necessarily as often, and so that leaves me to do more storytelling and things like that, which is what I'd much rather spend my time on instead of, you know, gee, did he have cover? Fine, he has cover, whatever you say, you know, it's, I'll move on, you know, but that's how the table has to decide it, I think.
So it becomes more important when there are other rules surrounding it. Like if someone has a power that ignores a certain amount of cover but doesn't ignore concealment, it suddenly becomes really important to determine whether someone has cover or concealment because that's going to affect how that person uses that power in any given encounter. But I don't think that... that means that you have to have let me put it this way. I don't think that that means that every group needs to always use rules as written. I think it's perfectly fine to say as a group decide, you know, we're going to go with whatever the DM says. In terms of narrative, like I can turn, you know, if someone says, does this guy have cover? I can actually, say to them, well, here's what you see, and describe it and turn it into a sort of narrative and sort of fill out what, you know, in their imagination, what the battlefield really looks like.
Right.
If I get a little leeway in how to describe something, right? Rather than just doing a strict, oh, corner to corner or whatever.
Right, because corner to corner doesn't necessarily help you with a half wall.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
And I don't like running stealth rules as written because there are some really cool things that should work, but because you're technically now out of cover, you're supposed to be seen automatically.
Right.
But, yeah, so it just is like, well, but that's boring. I mean, that's great if you're playing a tactical minis game, but if you're playing a story, you know what? The guy, the bard across the room should totally be able to be like, hey guys, look, Spider-Man, and they all look, and then the thief is able to sneak over. Like, that's more fun to me, and I don't care what the rules say, and you know what, if I'm not playing D&D, then so be it. I'm just joking.
Yeah.
No, you're right though, Trace. I mean, those are exactly the kind of things, and like, for example, just to use your example, for me to do that, it would be an opposed role. It would be the guy calling out, hey, look over there, his bluff check versus your stealth. And if the stealth won, then you remain invisible in the bluff check. Or if the bluff – how would I do that? Now I'm second guessing myself.
You'd roll a bluff for the crowd to see – or a bluff for the guy saying, hey, look over there, against the crowd's insight. And then if the thief was stealthing by, you could actually – roll the thief's, you know. So what the way I would do it is I would do that. Maybe it depends on the situation. I might just give it to him.
Well, yeah.
And then as the thief or whoever uses stealth to go by, if their stealth roll is really good, there doesn't need to be any opposition. Now if they roll a two, you know, I might say, oh, you know, okay, look, you know, you don't think anybody saw you, but then secretly maybe one of the people did see you, and so it's going to catch you or something, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, see, but that's the thing, right? I would rather be able to have the leeway to call that how I want to and not, you know, and not have to go look in the rules compendium and say, okay, stealth says this.
Somebody say, well, you know what? There's this power that if you had taken or this feat that you had taken, you totally could have done that. But see, so you didn't take it. No, we can't do it. I'm like, well, first of all, you're not the DM. Very sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Second of all, you know what? It's cool enough. It should go. Unless the table, unless, like you said, the table isn't into that type of game. But then again, I'm probably not DMing that table, not because I have a problem with that style of play. I'm just not very good at it. That's just, it doesn't make me incredibly happy to play that way. And I don't remember rules that well. I'm not, and this is the other problem I have with the whole rules as written thing. The people like to think it's a level playing ground, but it's not. People who have the time and the ability to memorize lots of rules do better at it than people who don't. And I hate the fact that people are always saying, well, it's a level playing ground. No, it's not. For me, it's not. It's a huge issue for me because I can't remember all that minutia. I mean, do you know, I was looking through today and we were talking earlier about the endurance checks in difficult conditions. There's a whole table of modifiers who apply to different conditions from cold to frigid cold.
Oh yeah.
And on top of it, if you take an extended rest while in one of those areas, you gain back the healing surges you didn't lose due to the harsh conditions. So if you have to do an endurance check and you lose a healing surge, you can't get them back until you're out of harsh conditions.
Right.
But you can get your other healing surges back. Like, at least according to the original DMG. Who knows? Yeah. It could have been errated since then. But that's a lot to remember.
Mm-hmm.
When it you is. Think about all of the different areas where that could apply.
So I actually have kind of a rule at my table, and that is that we don't look up rules at the table. Once that session starts, we don't look up any rules.
Yeah.
If there's a question about something during the game, I make a ruling on it, or if it's something that someone, you know, one of the players or several of the players find very important, we actually will, you know, if it really begs discussion, which so rarely happens, it's not even almost worth mentioning, but it might be for a newer group. If it really begs discussion, we'll stop and we'll discuss it. If they feel it's that important, I don't like doing that because it breaks the narrative and it breaks the flow. Mm-hmm. But if it's necessary to some of my players, then that'll make them happy to decide it right then. But we still don't look at the rules. We talk about it and we say, what really makes sense in this situation? And then that's it. That usually doesn't happen though. What usually happens is I make a ruling. And if a player goes away that week and in between that and the next session looks up the rule and says, you know, I think this was ruled wrong and I'd really like to start using this actual rule as it's written because I think it's more fair, then I'll consider that. If they could make a good case for it, I'll consider it. But in most cases, it's, you know, DM by the seat of the pants, you know, I'll make the ruling. And if it makes sense, usually the players say, oh, yeah, that makes sense, regardless of whether it's what the rule truly is or not.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and my base rule is the what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If they're okay with the monsters being able to do that to them, then I'm usually okay with them being able to do it to the monsters.
Right.
I mean, obviously, you still have to make some judgment calls and everything else. But, you know, I think that's a pretty fair one.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, yeah. So I think if you allow me to sum up a little bit, we could keep talking about it. But I think what it comes down to is that, yeah, well, for extended campaign games, there may be an issue that's broken here. It's not the end of it. I think that there are workarounds that will work for your table, and I think that you have to talk to your table about it and say, look, here's, you know, this is an issue, or do you think this is an issue, and we can change it. And, you know, you're not going to break the game. You're not going to you know, suddenly not be playing D&D anymore. And, you know, you don't have to go all fanboy on it just because of that. So,
oh my God, we're playing Dresden Files now.
Yeah. Oh my. Yeah. Exactly. You know. Oh. You know.
Well, so, Tracy, come on. We knew you weren't playing D&D because you're not in the dungeon. So
I'm not in the dungeon. Yeah. Right. I'm a girl. You know.
Yeah, that's why.
Let's bring out all the tropes. Right. Exactly. So. But, you know, Tracy, to your point, though, when you were talking about playing with groups that are very rule-centric like that, I mean, the virtual table we did on Sunday, those guys seemed very, very well-versed in the rules.
Right. And I felt bad because I'm not as well-versed.
I was right there with you. I was like, so what? Who cares? You know, just go up the road. I mean, there's stairs there. Why would that suffer movement? You know, it's like it wasn't a big deal. So,
yeah, and I mean, and it's like I'm really not trying to put down that style of play at all. It, you know, lots of people really enjoy it.
Like that. that. Some folks like it. Yeah.
And but it's just very hard for me to play that way. And I felt that was part of the reason I felt terrible during that game. Like, I felt like I was being a terrible DM because I couldn't. I tried. I wanted to give you, because you asked if you could take that penalty for standing up from prone as a minor, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then take a penalty to your attack roll. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? I'm fine with that. But somebody overruled me. They're like, oh, if you had the boots. And I was like, okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I actually heard one. I could have sworn I heard one of the designers mention that. Like Chris Sims or somebody like that mentioned that as a – is either a regular house rule he is or – something that he implemented later on. I don't know. I know I had heard that before, yeah. Though. So, yeah. But I don't. Yeah, but it was. Okay. I was cool with it. I mean, it was whatever. So.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't want any of them to think like that. I'm upset or anything because I'm not. I just. It was one of those misaligned expectations thing that I should have known more about and set up right away, rather than having it come up in the middle of a game like that. And that was my. That was where I failed.
Well, you have more guts than me because I could never DM a game like that. So that would just – I would be like, ah. So
What did you do?
Well, I ran the Brothers Gray adventure as part of the VT – the virtual table beta. They asked a bunch of us to run a game to help them test out certain parts of the system.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And so I ran it. Part of it was that it's a really hard adventure to run, I think, particularly on the virtual table. It's pretty short. It's
fuzzy, too.
There's a lot of fuzziness to it.
Yeah, there is.
The encounters are kind of strange to me. Like, the last encounter has characters way above, like, pretty much pretty far above the player's level. And it has like two level encounters. Like, there's a lower level and an upper level, but it's all part of the same encounter. And they and it says things like the guy in the lower level comes up, but it doesn't tell me how he comes up. And I'm looking at him like, why would this guy come up?
Yeah,
like why would he doesn't have an easy way of doing that? I mean, I guess he could have snuck out a door and then come in the other door to go up. I don't know. There was just lots of things that were left out. It's also a very early adventure. I think it was a 2009 adventure.
Yeah, it was from a while back. Yeah.
So. I don't mean to put it down too much, but
no, I had fun as a player.
The thing is, it sounds like that adventure is sort of made for the type of DM that'll do things like off the cuff, accept that suggestion of, oh, can I stand up for a minor if I take a negative to my attack roll? I mean,
oh yeah.
If the adventure is fuzzy, that sort of see that I like those types of adventures if I can run it the right way, because then I feel like I could make those judgment calls.
Right. There's lots of things to play with. There's hanging chains. There's a chute you can slide down.
Yeah.
There's lots of cool stuff like that.
Tracy, you know what I was going to do, but I didn't get a chance to, is I was going to ask you if I could center one of my lightning-keyed powers on the chain to electrocute him on the chain. I mean, doesn't that make sense? I totally would let you do that. Right, yeah. Exactly. But I could, yeah, but I didn't get a chance to because the guys did something else and he fell anyway. But it was like, man, I totally wanted to do that.
Yeah, and they had
it's in the rules. You're never going to see, I don't see anywhere where you can use a power to target necessarily an object. And then have it affect something else. I mean, you can set the AC of an object of like 5 or 10 or whatever, some low number, because it's a stationary object. But then there's really no way to – there's no way to say, well, if a certain power is, you know, electricity conducts, lightning conducts. So that makes sense. It would maybe be more difficult to rule other power sources that way. But like I'm saying, yeah, I mean that would be one of those kind of situations.
Well, and that one would have just been more of a flavor thing, to be honest, really. Like, you know, you could say the attack roll is whether or not you hit the chain. And if you hit the chain, obviously the guy is going to, you know, get electrocuted from it. But, you know, for sake of simplicity, we'll make the chain have the same difficulty to hit as, you know, the guy himself, if we wanted to be fair. Or maybe I'd give you a bonus, like I'd lower it a little bit to make it a little easier to hit. Although I could just as easily argue that the chain is thinner. So,
well, sure.
So, like, there's lots of ways you can do that, but it would have been cool, at least at the very least, to have been able to describe it that way. The other problem with that adventure is that it had a 300-foot drop in it.
Mm-hmm.
With characters that had the ability to teleport targets.
Yeah, that's
painful.
Like, I mean, so there were no pregens, but, I mean, even apparently first-level characters can have a daily that allows you to teleport a target. Or to, you know, to push them, and there's no railing to give them a bonus mm-hmm. against for the save to not fall.
Right.
So, so that was hard. And then it also didn't... So it described that there was 300-foot drop, but the lift... There was a lift in there somewhere that was only 30 feet down, but it didn't say, like, where the lift was, and if... It was just... It was hard.
Yeah, there's some issues with the adventure, but we had fun and
but
it does showcase some of those examples that we were just talking about. So
right, and like the monsters hardly did anything to you guys, maybe to a couple of you guys, but I think you were all pretty fine with your number of healing surges.
Mm-hmm. I never used a second wind once.
Yeah.
So.
And that had three encounters altogether. So,
yeah, exactly.
But, awesome.
But it ran really quickly.
Let's see. We ran, 3 hours?
Yeah. And yeah. I think part of that was just, you know, getting everybody ready and to go. I think we started a little later, too.
Yeah. But.
So people keep talking about the combat length.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they do. Shall we go around the table again and just describe how we just, instead of complaining about that, let's just come up with, just give them our solutions, and then they can go from there.
Well, I like better the other suggestion of, you know, asking the right question. It's not, combat length itself isn't the big issue. The big issue is that, as we were talking about a little earlier, for some groups, the fact that every encounter is this big to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, grinds on them. That's one issue.
Yeah, and sometimes the issue is table management.
Right.
Right.
It's not the combat itself. It's the players, because maybe they are used to having a grindy combat every time. And so even if a DM, after running for 6 months like that, if a DM tries to shorten up the combats and make them more concise, if the players are used to having, you know, 10 minutes in between a turn and playing on their iPhone and doing other stuff, then those combats are still going to be long no matter what you do. Because if the players are acting like that, then, mm-hmm. you know, that's going to prolong everything.
Well, I think a big... Go ahead, Tracy.
No, you go ahead.
I just think a lot of the responsibility does actually lie with the DM. I was adding this... I was doing just pure math the other day, and I was assuming 2 minutes a player. That gives you time mm-hmm. to roll the dice, to choose your power, to make sure the DM has logged damage if he did any. And if you have 6 players around the table, which I do, not including the DM, that's 12 minutes. You got, mm-hmm. and I figure 1 minute for each minute the players are using for the DM, because he's got at least as many monsters usually as players. Now his management goes down as the hopefully or mm-hmm. assume it will as the combat progresses, so his time will get shorter and shorter, but it starts off at probably a minute for each minute the players are taking. So you're talking at minimum round 1, 24 minutes. That's almost a half hour for 6 players. That's pretty basic. I don't know if you can work that down anymore. I mean, you're really going to have to do some pretty strange things as far, and your players are going to have to do some odd behaviors to get it down even less. And that's going to be, you know, things like rolling all of your dice like before the game and writing them on a chart and then crossing them off as you go, or weird
Which
things
I
like
don't,
that.
I don't like doing that because it's
don't
not
either.
As fun.
Well, it takes the fun out of it. You're absolutely right, Sam. And so, so there are some sort of doing some really bizarre things. You know, you're talking almost a half hour per round anyway. With 6 players now. Now I realize the standard's 5. So, but even then, that's only slightly less. So that's only 20 minutes. So, I don't know. Combat's, and to me, from edition to edition, having played different ones, hasn't changed that much. At least not for us. I mean, I know a lot of people are in love with Dragon Age and how it can do certain things theoretically to shorten combat. I don't really buy it, because you're still the DM or somebody still has to make a determination, still has to weigh it. You still have to discuss it with each other as to, you know, can I do this? Is this okay? In fact, without specific rules like we were talking about earlier, it's sometimes more difficult to make a decision on what you want to do. Because if anything is open, then you could, there's all kinds of choices you could do, and you can run into paralyzation, decision paralyzation. So it's like, you know, screwed one way or the other. So I don't know. I think the DM holds a lot of the responsibility for making sure that time progresses. You manage your players, like Sam, you were just saying, you know, use a timer or whatever. I think making sure that your board is set up or your tabletop is set up in an efficient manner. And that's something I've always struggled with because I'm a real prop whore. So it's tough to, you know, I want to set up all the cool stuff for every combat, no matter what, you know, and my own wife has given me ideas on what to do with tiles and things like that, that, you know, hey, you'll bundle them all together before the adventure. Then you just lay them out. It's like, oh yeah, you know, that makes sense. That kind of stuff. But those are, you know, at least from my, you know, aged wisdom or whatever, that's what it comes down to. It's a lot of that. And I don't think you're going to break it down a whole lot more.
Well, there's – so I – aside from the sort of so I have three things to say. The first one is my sort of standard answer of, you know, reduce monster hit points and up their damage. And you'll the battles will increase – or the battles will decrease in time and increase in sort of tension. But that doesn't always work. And it's not necessarily a cure-all, especially if you're not really good at the sort of encounter maths, you know. So people often throw that out, and I throw that out there a lot because it's sort of the quickest, easiest way for me to do it, because I've been DMing long enough that I sort of understand the way my groups work, because I run several different games. But that doesn't always work. So my first thing is, not every encounter, and we said this earlier, has to be a centerpiece. So right. It's okay to have some encounters where the players just kick ass. And they do it quick, and maybe it is just one round. So everybody gets an attack, and everybody gets to, you know, take out one of the monsters in a really cool way, and they just really just decimate them really quickly, and that's okay. So not every encounter has to be a centerpiece. But the one thing that that I started doing that really actually made my job easier was, unless an encounter was a sort of centerpiece, big bad villain encounter, I run the most simplest monsters possible.
Yeah.
And you know, they have two powers maybe, you know. They don't do a lot of really cool stuff, but I make up for that by maybe narrating or maybe having them interact with the players or, you know, throw sort of a skill challenge type thing into the encounter to keep it interesting and new, but the creatures aren't necessarily that difficult, right? But, you know, those things only speed up your encounter so much. I think Randall has a point about, you know, you're always going to have at least 20 to 30 minutes no matter what, because there's just no way around it.
Right. Per round.
So if you think that 20 to 30 minutes is too long per round, and you think that two rounds, or if 2.5 rounds is around the average that you want your combat to go, then that's going to be an hour and a half. And if an hour and a half is too long a combat for you, then, you know, I don't know what to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So I did
Tracy,
away with,
go.
I did away with XP. Mm-hmm. I know that gets under some players' skins because they really want to see the numbers increase. And I understand that. But at the same time, when people are worried about XP, they're worried about killing every creature. Because they want to make sure they get all the XP. Mm-hmm. And also,
I do that too. My parties level when I tell them to level.
Yeah, and it's a lot of bookkeeping. The other thing is you can add terrain, including terrain that does damage, if you're worried about trying to make your players feel scared. Like if they suddenly trigger a glyph on the floor that causes, you know, 2d6 worth of damage to them, and there looks to be 10 more on the board. You know, you don't have, it's not a monster, you know, you're not dealing with that bookkeeping every round, but you're still doing some damage to them. Obviously, you have to temper it by, you know, what level they are and everything. Don't do that to first level. Well, or do it.
Well, there's the fine art of the TPK, you know?
I think that the key words in her first sentence were there looks to be a bunch more.
Right. Yeah. Not all of them actually necessarily have to trigger if they step on it. I mean, and you want to keep that to a minimum because you don't want them going around the entire dungeon or entire whatever with a 10-foot pole looking at every five feet. But occasionally doing it is kind of fun, I'll admit.
Yeah, run up to Tomb of Horrors, they'll be doing that for the rest of your games. Yeah, that's so true. That's too fun, though.
The other thing is, you know, I don't care about killing the player characters. Like that. I mean, I want them to feel like they're in danger. And there are a few ways of doing that. It's like, obviously, hit points and healing surges are one way to do it. Having them have goals that are outside of combat also helps, too. If you put something that they really want to have happen in jeopardy... And that's kind of like what you guys were talking about earlier with Mike Shea and Dave Chalker. That's the alternative, like, victory conditions and goals. Could be, like, you know what, if you keep doing this, it looks like the temple's going to fall in on itself and you really need to get this artifact out of there before it does that. You know, who cares at that point? At that point, the monsters are just there to slow the party down so that they might not achieve their objective rather than killing them. You've just totally changed the focus of the encounter.
Yeah, that's what I mean when I say adding a skill challenge or something
to
the encounter. It gives a secondary focus rather than the combat itself.
Exactly.
And the pull from something that I think that's pretty old school is the whole factions argument. Like, if you have some well-developed factions or groups in your campaign, and the actions the characters take in the course of their adventuring... determines their reputation with those various groups, and you know they know that those groups exist and want to have a good reputation with them, then you've also now changed what the encounter is about. It's no longer about necessarily killing everything, because one of your enemies could be the son of the local noble that you want to be on their good side. You probably don't want to kill them, to kill that person. And you may not even want to, you know, knock them out. You may want to say, you know, find some other way to get them to leave. Or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That's why that's actually what brought up this sort of guilds and groups idea. I was going through a bunch of my old Dragon magazines, and there's a series of articles in the old 3.5 and 3.0 edition Dragons. Most of the time they were by Andy Collins, I think, but they're a Guild Secrets article, and it really goes through like these societies or guilds or different organizations, and you know, it's usually like 2 or 3 page article, not a huge like, oh, here's giant stuff, but it's always interesting to me that when I run campaigns, because I run them in my home world, I sort of keep track of, and my players sort of don't know this, but I keep track of what they're doing and who they're upsetting. And Tracy's right. That means that some people in the world are going to be unhappy with them. And some people are going to be extremely happy with them. And those are going to be competing interests, so that when they get up to the higher heroic tier, they're going to start having to deal with that, because now they're going to become more powerful. And the people that are already powerful in the world, now they're going to have to start dealing with them. So they have this sort of reputation score to pull from Baldur's Gate.
Oh my God.
You
know,
yeah.
It's an MMO.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That'll be that's what calls out next. Yeah.
Yeah, well, somebody said that to me this morning when I brought up the whole, one of the things that might be a good thing to add to a DM's toolbox is a reputation management system. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to use the exact one, but putting the idea out there and getting people to think of it that way, you know, may be a good thing for, you know, for a Dungeon or Dragon article or something like that, or a Cobalt Quarterly article. Right. And getting people to think along those lines, and somebody reply with, oh, it's an MMO. But you know what? I know.
But here's the thing, though. The initial Baldur's Gate for the PC was not an MMO. It was a PC game.
Right.
It was a PC RPG. And it used a reputation score, because if you did evil stuff, you would walk into town and the guards would immediately attack you.
Right. Well,
because you were evil bastards.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's really then based on the alignment system to begin with. And I'm sure someone somewhere in the history of D&D had already done this.
Oh, are you kidding?
Baldur's...
Yeah,
oh,
yeah. Oriental Adventures.
Oh, yeah.
Oriental Adventures in first edition started with honor points.
Right.
And you actually started off the game with a certain amount of reputation and honor, and bad things could happen to you if your armor, mm-hmm. if your honor, excuse me, can't talk, dropped to a certain level. Well, and so, yeah.
And I thought Keep on the Borderlands was partly, I thought there were factions there that you might negotiate with to try to go to do things that you wanted to help you. I thought maybe
the original Keep on the Borderlands.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I think so, but it depends on how it gets run.
Right. No, but I mean, so, is like the ideas are there.
Yeah. Right. Like, oh, absolutely.
This is
absolutely.
Not, this is not new.
No, this is not new. Trust me, none of the ideas I come up with are new. Okay, I'll just lay that out right now. But for some people, they're new, right? Because for some people, they're just new to the game, or they're, you know, they haven't been in it for a long time. So that's, you know,
That was the hard part I was having, because I wanted to be generic enough that I didn't spoil anything. Mm-hmm. Even though, like, how old is the module?
Right.
But
right.
I know some people are finding it for the first time, so I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah. And while I like that idea, to me, if, like, for example, you just mentioned that you don't track experience points because of the overhead, to me, tracking honor points would be the same way. I mean, you're giving up one for the other and still tracking extra crap. So it's like, I'm not sure I would do either one.
Well, so I don't, you know. I don't actually do, like, honor points. What I do is depends on, you know, so at the beginning of a campaign, the group sort of determines where they're starting in the world. Mm-hmm. And because my world is pretty developed, and you could do this in any sort of published world too, or in your own campaign, but my world's pretty developed. So in whatever region that they're adventuring in, you know, I know who the active groups are in those regions and who the active sort of power players are in terms of like political and nobility and stuff like that. And so I can have a list of those, and you know, it's got two columns, good and bad. And if the party does something that really pisses off, say, some noble family from Donir, then they get a little tick mark in the bad, you know, in the bad column. And then later on, if they make someone from whatever society really happy, they get one tick mark in the, you know, I mean, we're talking major stuff. We're not talking, you know, they insulted some poor person in the street, right? So, but by the time they get up to upper heroic tier, when this starts to become important, there's several tick marks in different places in that chart, and it's very simple to keep track of. It's not like honor points for each character and whatever. I just basically do it on a party level.
Well, it's kind of like in some ways, a skill challenge without sticking to that X before Y thing. So, because I've been kind of using the skill challenge framework to, in my mind, to abstract it out. The other thing is, I would keep track of XP if the party wasn't meant to level together. Like, if individual XP mattered, then I would do it, because, you know, then it matters. But once you've decided that the party levels at the same time, it doesn't really matter, other than to show them how far they've progressed. And I think there are other ways of doing that, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. In fact, I'm getting away from experience points myself, because it just became too much. It was a pain in the neck to keep track of. Much easier to just tell them when they can level, when the assumption is, like you just said, that they're all raising at the same time.
Right. So. Well, and part of the problem with doing the XP is, like, they'd always ask me at the end of the session what XP they earned for the session, and I was like, well, this one adventure had this, like, this one encounter had this thing where the minions regenerate it, and so you're, like, so then I'm trying, it's not like I already had the XP already known, because it really mattered what they did. And I was just like, you know what, it's too much for me at the end of the session to try to figure this all out after, you know, because I'm already beat and tired from having, you know, two, 3 hours of improv, basically. I'm like, I can't do math anymore. I can't do it. You killed all my monsters. I'm depressed. You know, just give me some time. But yeah, so that was the other reason that it was more for me, too, that I couldn't do it anymore, doing the XP. But yeah.
I mean, I used to do XP, but basically what I found was they weren't leveling fast enough for me, for my story. So, you know, I would have to throw in these extra encounters that were worthless, and that's sort of against my gaming philosophy, right? Or my DMing philosophy. Which sounds way more highfalutin than I mean it. But, you know, I don't really I don't want to throw extra encounters at them if they're really unnecessary. You know, if they really don't have a reason to, you know, run into some group of creatures that they end up slaughtering, then why do it? You know, and if the only reason is, well, they need that XP so that they can be level 2 by the time they get to the next thing, then I'd be like, no, there's no point for that. So it's actually easier to just get rid of XP and, you know, I didn't do that until I had been DMing the same group for a year and a half, because by then I sort of had a really good feel about, you know, how they were going to play and how I could level them and whatnot. And then we started a new campaign and I said, okay, I'm not doing XP. And the second campaign was much, much more fun than the first.
Yeah. Cool.
Tracy has a question.
I have a question.
I've
been told that I'm worrying about this too much. So I'd like your guys' opinion. So in Robert Schwab's famous article about reexamining the dungeon, he talks about, and other people have mentioned this too lately when they talk about combat length. They say, you know, take a regular encounter, or maybe Rob says to bump it up by about 2 levels or so, but then divide it into sub-encounters in a sector. Now, Rob's suggestion is that you roll initiative for each of those sub-encounters. I'm a little nervous about that, because I think if you divide the monsters up, and you have the party go against each, like, smaller division, that if you roll initiative each time, the people who have the higher initiative modifier are going to have enough additional turns that it's noticeable and makes the other players feel less effective. And I'm wondering what you guys, like, how you guys feel about that.
Sam, do you want to go first?
Sorry.
What do you want me? No.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, first, my players often roll completely abysmally, so I've seen guys with the get +8 on their initiative. I'm usually one of those guys because I always take improved initiative. But but anyway, roll 1s and get 9s, and so I don't see a trend often enough in my games for that. I think that as far as dividing it up, like Schwab suggests, the only issue I see with that is, what was I going to say? It had to do with the flow of the game. I'm trying to figure out. Let's say you have 4 rooms that are connected together. You're going to make it 1 encounter, but you're going to encounter 1 room at a time. My players are going to assume that even if you've just killed a few of them, that they can take a rest. Unless you hack.
Hello? Did we lose him?
Actually have those monsters actively barging in.
You know what?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you popped out for a second. So you said they're going to want to take a short rest.
Yeah, my players are going to want to take a short rest. And I don't know if that, I think it defeats the purpose, unless you have the monsters crashing in, or like I think he's suggesting, is, if I remember correctly, wandering monsters. He's going back to wandering monsters or patrols that are going to barge in on them and preventing the rest.
Or you could say that until they've reached their. So the other part of his thing is that there you have a goal for the encounter area.
Mm-hmm.
So until you've reached that goal, you can't take a short rest. You could do that too.
Oh, right. Okay. And that would probably work. As far as Tracy's comment on thinking it might give certain players an advantage on initiative, I wouldn't necessarily see that. Not in the number of times I played. Maybe statistically. Yes, pure mathematically, it probably would have a difference. But I think that's going to happen regardless of how the encounters are structured. I think that's a point on how many times you roll initiative during the game.
Right.
So
the point here is that you're actually doubling or tripling, potentially, the number of times you roll initiative per game. And you have smaller encounter groups, so that unlike a regular encounter where you might lose 1 turn out of 3 to 5 rounds, you may lose 1 turn out of every round. Depending on how
I see. Okay, I see. See, I was under the impression that I think I was under the impression it was just the opposite, that you only rolled one initiative per zone.
Mm-mm.
And you kept the same initiative the whole time. Oh, my bad. Okay. Well, yeah, you're probably right. I mean, it might. I mean, again, my players roll pretty abysmally, so I don't know if that would really impact or not.
Do they roll equally abysmally, or is it only the people with the high initiative that roll poorly?
No, it pretty much goes around the table. It's the cursed rolls are pretty generic around my or pretty what's the word? Unspecific.
See, Randall does a little ritual before the game.
That's right.
He cleans his house, and then he gets all the dice that he lets them use, and he does a little ritual around it, and then they roll ones and threes. Throughout the whole,
my monsters have been rolling poorly lately, and this is why I think it's so much on my my mind, is because they often don't go until like way later, and by that point they're already bloodied, and I'm like, well, they're gonna last one more round. Why not take the extra 8 damage right now just to attack the guy that's not the Palak?
Mm-hmm. So I have to say that before I address Tracy's question, Skype is perfect for suspense for this podcast, because Randall, you said, well, my players would want to take a short rest, and so unless you and then there was and it's like let's pause for a moment and
that's
set up the
awesome.
suspense, and that happens every time. It's always someone saying, well, I think that, and then blank.
It's like the Dick Cavett show.
So I don't know, I think I see the problem. I see the problem in that, you know, If you're running 5 encounters instead of what might have been one big encounter, or maybe two smaller but larger than each individual 5, you might have the person who has improved initiative and who rolls a 19 and goes first, and they might consistently roll well. And then so in every encounter they go first, and if the encounter is shorter because it's much smaller than the whole, then that player always gets to attack at least once in every combat. And the slower player, there might just be nothing for them to do by the time it gets to be their turn, which is relatively boring. I don't know. I haven't run, because I don't run the dungeon style a lot, I haven't run anything like what Mr. Schwalb suggests, but I could see where there'd be a problem. I think, I don't know, the way to do that and to alternate initiative is maybe you just roll one initiative, but then you take that person who had the highest initiative and you pop them down to the bottom of the list for the second encounter. But then that's not fair either. So, I mean, you know, it just, I don't know. I don't know.
See,
maybe I would just run one initiative and just keep them. See, the thing is, if you're not actually breaking encounters really, then you can just keep initiative and let them, you know, you just make them act in initiative order the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which also prevents the short. That also prevents the short rest, because you never break initiative. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead, Tracy.
Oh, no. I mean, I like keeping the initiative order. I could see if you wanted to do a little more exploration that keeping the strict initiative order could be difficult. But I think keeping it over the course of the encounters, and sure, it's a, you know, it's a gamist type of thing to say, but it's just being honest with the players. Like, listen, well, and that's part of the problem with the length of combat question is, like, what is a combat? You know, is one of these small, like, do you want 3 of these smaller encounters within a night because you feel that it pushes the story along? Okay, well, can we make some concessions because, like, it originally was designed for this particular way and now we're changing it, then that could give, you know, some, I'm worried that it could give some pretty big benefits to people who decide to invest in initiative. And and somebody on Twitter today, because I had talked about this a lot on Twitter, and somebody said, you know, accused me of not wanting to reward players that invested in initiative. I'm like, it's not that at all. It's just if we keep initiative order, even though it's, you know, we view it as 3 different encounters, it's neutral, right? Like, it's like as if we were just running an encounter. It's no different. If I change it to where we roll initiative each time, I'm potentially taking away from other players to give to you, to give to somebody who's, you know, invested in initiative. And on top of it, I'm also creating an incentive to spend your feats on improved initiative, which overall in the game may be boring. Like, I may want them to run, you know, they may want, it may be more interesting if they use those feat slots for something else than improved initiative.
Hush you. I will always use improved initiative.
Well, no, I mean, And that's cool because that's the type of character you want to play. But like, let's say you were a person that really would rather use that feed slot to learn 7 more languages.
Well, true. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, if that guy never gets to talk because he rolls such poor initiative most of the time, like, I mean, we're talking +4 is +4 for improved initiative.
Yeah.
So that's 20%, right?
You guys, you're reminding me of the Darkness Rising improved initiative where the woman comes in and she builds this character and the one guy doesn't have any faith in the fact that maybe she could build an effective character. And he was like, oh, no, you should take this and this. And she goes, no, I took improved initiative. And he says, who takes improved initiative? And she proceeds to explain to him how she did this really awesome combination. And it basically made her crit range 16 to 20. Right. And every time she crits on a hit, she gets to attack again. And so the first combat they get in, she kills like 20 goblins.
Yeah,
and she's like, it's she's the like there. Yeah. That's who takes improved initiative, you know? Yeah. But I see the issue. I don't know. I think probably if I did that, I would not. So there's a couple of issues here. The short rest one, what I would do is if I decided I was going to roll different initiatives for each one, if the player said, oh, well, let's rest, whatever, I would basically say to them, look, you are not resting here. You hear creatures stalking about in, you know, through the walls. You hear movement. You hear creepy noises. You do not want to rest here.
Right.
And, you know, quit metagaming and put yourself in the PC's position. You are not going to rest here. You know, it's like a haunted house times 1,000. You're not going to rest here. Okay. Yeah. Regardless of whether I set some sort of external goal, which usually I try to do because I'm pretty good at that. But pretend I didn't. I would still tell them, no, you can't take a short rest. So that issue would go away. I don't know. I probably would not have them roll initiative each time. I would probably do it once, and I would see the problem that Tracy's talking about, and I would probably not do it again. And I would just have them act in initiative order throughout the entire thing. And, you know, that doesn't mean that if someone's doing a movement, they have to only go 5 squares, because then it takes forever to get to the next mini encounter or whatever. But when as soon as they heard something and they needed to act in a sort of encounter type situation, whether it was someone who said, oh, I hear something, I want to stealth now, we would immediately go into, okay, now we're on the grid and let's deal with it in initiative order.
Right.
And starting from the last person who, you know, the next person whose turn it is to go.
The other question I have, the essential fighter, is that an aura now, the defending aura, instead of just one? Or is it just one creature still? I forget.
I'd have to look it up.
Me too. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm worried in general.
You need a rules lawyer.
I know. I'm worried in general too with the if smaller means fewer number, like if you go down to 2 creatures of approximately the character's level, that between defender auras and curses and stuff, they just get locked down so that they're never a threat to the wizard in the party.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other soft squishy that I like to go after. I hate defender auras. I gotta be honest. Or like any of that stuff. Particularly ones that do auto damage if you don't attack.
Ranged combatants. Everyone has a bow. All monsters have bows.
Well, right. But the thing is as soon as the defender comes up and engages with them, they're locked down.
But the bowmen retreat after every move. I mean, after every shot. That's just the thing. If you keep your archers moving and your ranged attacks moving, the defender aura has less effect. And that's just about encounter.
What you do is you allow the archer to shift before
right.
it can shift before it attacks as right. part of the attack, just like,
well,
just
goblins do that, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Right, but you have to have enough room and everything in order for them to continually right. shift and knock exactly. it.
Yeah, that's true.
So what's the oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was going to move on. So if you
No, I'm fine.
Okay. So what's the fluff question, Randall?
Well, the fluff question is this. Here on the DM roundtable, we talk a lot about some rules and pretty crunchy stuff a lot of the time, but I think it would be nice. Yeah. Nice.
Sorry.
I'm a developer. I can't help it.
Yeah, I know. It's okay. We love you anyway. But the thing is this. I think sometimes it would be nice, even if as a regular part of the show, that we talk a little bit about where, as DMs, we're getting inspiration for doing some things. Because it's not all about the numbers. It's about the story. And the thing that brought this to mind, at least on my end, and I'll throw the question out. I'll tell you what I was thinking about, and then I'll throw the question out to you guys. But my wife and I just recently finished watching the whole Firefly series and the movie Serenity. Something we like to do every year. And it just it continues to grab me as a perfect example of an adventuring party. And each episode is like a new adventure, you know, literally, almost deliberately that can be or directly translated to things that happen in D&D. And some of the NPCs that they encounter are just amazingly written, you know, they're only in that episode maybe, but they're so well written that they're memorable. And those are the kinds of things that are inspiring me as a DM. When I watch that show, it's like, oh, I'm totally throwing that NPC into the game next time. You know, that's the kind of thing. So anyway, that's the fluff question is what kinds of things have you been watching or reading lately that are inspiring your storylines and your characters in your game?
Tracy, you want to take that?
Well,
you want me to go first? I can go first.
You go first. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, so I don't watch TV. And if Thaddeus was here, he'd be like, oh, yeah, you look down on everybody that doesn't watch TV. But that's not true. But I myself don't watch TV because I decided a long time ago that I don't have time to do that. And it's a personal choice I made. So I don't get inspiration from television shows. Mm-hmm. But there's a couple of places that I do. I mean, I mentioned before that I have a vast collection of Dragon magazine, and a lot of times I'll just, you know, it's sort of a little ritual I have that before I go to bed at night, I just grab one off the shelf and I just flip it open and I read whatever article is there. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. I do that with other magazines and with other – sometimes it's not a magazine. Sometimes I grab a book off the shelf and I have, you know, three giant bookcases full of RPG stuff that I just pull out and I read, you know, two or three pages. One of the things I do is because I'm pretty active on the RPG Geek site, and so we have this Iron Reviewer competition. So I've been trying to read things outside of like the D&D specific world and read it with a critical eye and write about how it inspires me to do things for my actual campaign, which is in D&D. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, you know, this is really sad to say, but I use my personal life as inspiration and just
nothing wrong with that.
I carry around a little notebook. And if something happens and I see something or I think of something, if I can relate it to anything, you know, D&D style or Gamma World style or, you know, anything like that, I just jot it down. I just jot down a note to myself. You know, I mean, so I work at a university and I teach a class right now that has 300 students in it. So, you know, that's 300 individuals that come up with the craziest crap to say. And they're very entertaining and they're very intelligent people. I mean, you know, and that's just the students. I mean, I also work with a department full of science geeks and mm-hmm. Of various ages. And some of the things that, you know, and it's not necessarily that they do something, but sometimes I just sit and watch people and I think of something, and maybe it's something that it's just, you know, something, and something will happen, and I'll think, you know, if you were an evil person, I never say this to the person, but I say, you know, if you were an evil person, you would have responded to this in this way. And I just sort of jot a note down. And about once a month, I go through my notebook and I look at stuff and I try to make connections. And a lot of it ends up being crap because I can't really connect it to anything in my current campaigns. Mm-hmm. I don't erase it or scratch it out or anything. It's not usable right then. But that's sort of where my inspiration comes from.
Cool.
God, we could probably spend an hour talking about my sources.
Well, then go to the recent past then.
Well, no, I mean, basically, I've always been a reader, and I read broadly. You know, when I was in middle school, I'd read everything from David Copperfield to Trail of Tears to, you know, history and geography of Africa. So I have a lot of that stuff to pull from. I love using Agatha Christie.
Wow, good idea, yeah.
Because I do a lot more urban or town-centered adventures, and, you know, it's trying to solve a mystery. It's not that hard. Agatha Christie's really great. I'm nowhere near her. But, you know, oftentimes it's the person you least expect it, I mean, particularly with Nancy Drew books. I know people might have thought I was joking the other day about doing a whole Nancy Drew series in D&D. But, you know, just come up with stuff like that. Everything you... One of Miss Marple's favorite things is, like, she's learned everything she needs to learn about the world from small towns, because it all happens there. It's just in a different, it's just slightly different. People don't always recognize it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And just things like that. I watch a lot of movies. You know, the King Arthur movie. I love that one. We were talking about that on Twitter the other day, because I saw part of it again.
Which one? There's a thousand of them.
The one where Keira Knightley plays Guinevere.
Oh, the one where they escape over the ice river?
Yes.
Oh, that is a pretty good one.
That's and then also the battlefield with the fire.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's a good one. You can do skill challenge beforehand. Depending how well they do, they might be able to set that up, and then kaboom!
That's right. Yeah, that's a good. There's some good examples there. Yeah, exactly.
I saw the Season of the Witch? That was a recent one. That reminded me more of a 3.5 campaign, or maybe even earlier than 4E, because it's not great on the very heroic feel to it. and then I can even pull from, you know, modern TV shows like How I Met Your Mother. You know, sometimes there's some good remarks in there that I'll pull out. Because I put a lot of pop culture remarks in my game as a way to make the players laugh. Like Hans and Franz, my favorite one.
Oh, God.
One of them gets hit.
I have used Hans and Franz in the past. I've used that. Yeah, I know.
Franz! It's just fun to play. I know it breaks immersion for some people, but they're not at my table, so it doesn't matter.
Well, there you go.
So yeah, sorry.
So I read a lot too, and I do watch movies, even though I don't watch TV. We have a DVD player, and so we watch movies. But so I have a question about how you use books and movies, because I sort of use those for inspiration too. But normally when I read, so here's the thing: I read a lot of fantasy, and then I read like modern like cop drama or
detective dramas.
Detective dramas, but they're not always cops. Sometimes it's a psychologist, and sometimes whatever. The problem is that I often, I try to so here's my dilemma, right? So I try to make it different from the book, because I don't want it to be immediately obvious that it's totally like modeling this particular thing, right? But at the same time, I've also learned that if I want my players to catch on, I have to make it so obvious, like the clues have to be so obvious, and I have a hard time balancing that. I'm not sure that I'm as good at the sort of intrigue. It varies. My level of being able to DM that very well, it depends on the players and on a lot of different things. And sometimes I feel like it went off really well, and sometimes I feel like it didn't go off so well. But so how do you – so my question is, how do you – if you get a lot of your inspiration from books and movies, how do you sort of emulate those without making it really obvious, and at the same time making it obvious enough for the players to catch the clues so that they can actually solve the mystery? I mean, we could probably talk about this for 3 hours.
Well – I usually don't pull a mystery exactly out. Although, so at the game I ran at DDXP, I pulled a little bit from one of the original Nancy Drew, if not the original Nancy Drew book. It was, I think, The Mystery in the Clock or something.
Mm-hmm.
Where basically the whole answer to the mystery was tied to this clock, and that was clocks were the answer. To the mystery in this game. And then the other part of it was I evoked CSI without it being CSI. Like, basically, they're dead bodies. And they got to go examine them. And they're like, mm-hmm. well, you know, we'll use Arcana or we'll use religion to figure out what's going on. Oh, it's this. Okay, well, then, you know, we'll go on from there and look further. And so that way they knew right away what they were supposed to do. And, you know, one of them even made the sunglasses remark and everything else. And it was fun, you know, because they weren't lost. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't exactly an adventure from the CSI right. TV show. I don't know.
I think for my end of it, so I certainly watched plenty of movies and stuff like that. And like I said, a lot of shows I try to, if the writing is really good, I'm more focused on the characters than I am on the storyline, because I'm kind of a writer anyway, and so I know I'm familiar with certain plots and stuff like that. One example, though, where I actually did translate a movie plot directly to a game, and it was that the D&D campaign took place on a train. And it was the initial run of this train, and the train was attacked by Githyanki terrorists. And they held the people hostage, and I actually based it on that goofy who's the guy, kung fu guy, ponytail, fat, who's that guy,
Jackie Chan?
No, he's not fat. The guy that's he played a cook on the train. He's like some kind of ex-Navy SEAL, and he takes out the terrorists on the train. What is his name?
Fat? Well, you're not talking about Steven Seagal.
Yes, Steven Seagal.
He's not fat.
Yeah,
is he fat now? I haven't seen him in several years, I guess.
Yeah, Tracy, tell me. Yeah, come on.
I don't know if I'd call him fat, but he's not skinny.
Yeah,
he's got more of a – he's got a wide body build, but he's not fat.
Oh, Sam.
I don't – maybe I just haven't seen him in a long time. I mean, I guess the last movie I saw him in was – oh, Lord.
Yeah, well, see, there you go. But
yeah, so
– no, but Steven Seagal aside, but that was the basic plot. It was that I got that idea to have mm-hmm. this train from this movie that I happened to be watching on, like, USA Network one night or something, you know? And it's like – hey, this would translate into D&D, except for one guy. It'll be the party, and they will have been hired on as guards, you know, for this initial train trip. And, you know, the Githyanki will come in, and they're ruthless, and, you know, people will die, and it'll be awesome. So, you know, and that was the story. You know, and that was one example. But I actually, as far as plot-wise, I don't usually drop straight in at least from a movie. I've stolen recently from video games a lot, but that's a whole campaign based on a certain setting. So it's more of stealing the setting than anything else. But yeah, it's I like to go to the characters in well written movies and stuff before I worry about the storylines.
So I guess that's one of the reasons why I say I use my own life and just watching people, and because I deal more with characterizations, and I think that's probably one of the reasons also that it leads me to feel like I don't do as well with storylines that I try to sort of not lift whole cloth, obviously, but just sort of use the major parts of the intrigue or whatever and sort of tweak it to be a fantasy story or whatever. But I feel like I don't do as good a job of it because I more watch things and get inspiration in terms of characterizations. So I don't know. And I'm looking at this picture of Steven Seagal, and you're right. He has let himself go. let me try to find a better picture.
Well, when he was young, sure. I mean, I realized he was a martial artist. He let himself go, and he got kind of fat. Got jowls, you know. Martial artist guy should not have jowls.
Yeah, Under Siege is the one where he was the cook on the Navy ship.
Yes.
Yeah, and it turns out he was like ex-Navy SEAL, and the terrorists that attacked were like, "Who the hell is this guy?" You know.
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing. But yeah, because someone was actually talking about running a Die Hard adventurer. I don't know who was doing that. Was that Mike Shea?
I don't know, but that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it does sound cool.
No, you know what? It was Angry DM. Didn't he ask? He asked, if he sets that up, he said, oh, what did he said something about how long it took them to kill Bruce Willis, or how did they kill him in the end, or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I saw that tweet. Yeah, yeah, it was like, yeah, that would be great, except I can't remember how they killed Bruce Willis in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's good stuff. I mean, you can pull inspiration from just about anywhere. I mean, if you've read any of my recent blogs, you know, I pulled inspiration from a funeral that happened not too long ago, you know? Yeah. So, and it's anything can pull that idea. And Sam, you have great habits. I should really carry around. I have a moleskin. I'm looking right at it, but I don't carry it around with me, and I should, because mm-hmm. you get some great ideas doing that. So,
you know what else? So somebody was asking something on RPG Geek today, and I did this whole write-up. I think I'll turn it into a blog post, but it's basically he's starting a Gamma World game, and he needed help with how to present his town as a sort of Gamma World town, and he didn't know how to do it. And so this speaks directly to this conversation, because my response to him was basically the same thing that Mike Shea said in that one episode of the Dungeon Masters Roundtable a couple months ago, where he was actually quoting a WotC person. So, you know, this is all convoluted citation. But anyway, the point of it was, do something that's familiar and at the same time fantastic, and make sure that you keep it fun, or something like that, right?
Yeah, the three Fs.
Yeah, three Fs. Maybe one of them was functional or something. Like, I don't remember. But basically, so what I told the guy was, if you really want to use your hometown, pick three things that are really like familiar, either some place that everybody in the town knows about that has some sort of strange history or interesting history, or maybe it's just like, for me, it's the mall. Everybody in Ithaca goes to the mall. Okay, oops, I said my hometown. Anyway, everybody goes to the mall, right? Because the mall is where the target is. And so, you know, that's sort of – I picked the mall as the place where a bunch of these encounters are going to happen. And so I basically give this example of, you know, the mall has very interesting things. So if the mall in Gamma World was taken over by all the computer equipment that was there, then the shoe store, all the cash registers have made these elaborate traps made of shoes and shoestrings, and they're all strung together. And if you get trapped in there, you're going to have a really hard time getting out. Meanwhile, the pretzel vendor has grown this huge pretzel maze in the middle of the mall, and it separates the two parts of the mall. And
but you can eat your way out, right?
Right. The projectors in the movie theater have become sentient and started filming home movies of the projectors. And in the Target, there are two factions. There's the shopping carts who are against the television/computer consoles, and they've turned the Target into a war zone. And all the generic products in the Target are trying to escape, but of course they all have the Target symbol on them. So as soon as they try to escape and they go out in the open, they get killed because they've got a Target on them. So, you know, you've got this familiar thing of a mall, right? At the same time, there are two sort of things in Ithaca. There are these two towers that every year around New Year's, they turn on the lights all night so that it displays the year. And then on New Year's at midnight, it switches over and displays the new year. Well, I preempted that and made that into the domain of the Monkey Overlord. And so now they've got these two towers where they string rope bridges across, and they can do all these different acrobatic things and all these weird things. And they've started turning on and off the lights to create these weird symbols on the towers. And so anybody in Ithaca that's been in Ithaca for very long knows that that happens. And so it's very familiar to them, but I've taken it and turned it into something very, very different, but yet still familiar. So that's sort of the idea with my, where I get my inspiration in terms of, you know, watching people. I do the same thing. Right. You know, there's almost no one that you could identify in my game that my players could identify, because I have sort of changed that characterization so that's unrecognizable. You know, it's sort of the whole disclaimer at the beginning. All of these characters are fictional, whatever. But the kernel of it is based on something true, and that's what keeps it familiar. So if you keep a kernel of familiarity, it actually makes it more fun.
Oh yeah. I use Wikipedia.
When That's I need a good source.
When I need herbs or something, I try to find like herbs that you know, they may have used in medieval times and used those names because most people don't know what they are. But if they ever look in Wikipedia, they'll see, oh, that's where she got it from.
Well, now they will.
but yeah, no, I love doing that and seeing how, like, people used to, because then it makes sense, right? Because, I mean, this is oftentimes a game trying to at least somewhat model medieval, particularly Europe. Mm-hmm. You know, if you use something that people used at the time, you know, it gives that sense of it, but you can still turn it into whatever fantastical thing you want it to be. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And TV tropes. Don't forget TV tropes.
Oh yeah, TV tropes.
I actually read that to try to avoid things in my in my stories. It's like, maybe I shouldn't have that. Or at least to own up to them when I know that they're happening. It'll be like, someone will say, that is such a thing. And it'll be like, you're absolutely right. I did it on purpose. It was easy to drop in. Let's move on.
Right.
So, well, oh, interesting. Angry DM just tweeted to me that, let me know if you find something that works. I don't think my group is coming back to it anytime soon. Our last roundtable is any indication. You think I'm brutal? Also, turns out that they really don't like Gamma World.
Hmm.
I'm not sure why he's... I didn't tweet about Gamma World, but okay.
Well, he's saying the 4E rule set. They don't like the 4E rule set.
Oh, okay.
And Gamma World is basically the 4E rule set, but with with less sort of RAW.
Yeah.
I use that term because I know Tracy loves it.
her new favorite term, right after dungeon. So.
Oh, I know. I'm going to get kicked out of the D&D fraternity soon, I know.
Wait, there's a fraternity? Okay. Shit.
Wait, yeah, darn it. I don't have my secret decoder ring.
They're gonna...
Randall, you and I were sitting on the porch, so whatever.
They're going to cut my name out of the book. I'm no longer part of the family. Yeah.
She's lucky she can dance on the lawn.
I know.
Yeah.
I will use that to my advantage to keep into this brotherhood.
Exactly. So, well.
So it's been an hour and 46 minutes.
Yeah, we've had a pretty good run for a DM roundtable this evening.
Yeah. Sweet. Especially with just three of us.
I'd like to thank my co-hosts, DM Samuel and Tracy Hurley, for joining me. No.
Nice.
Sorry, I thought I'd throw a little professionalism on there, but yeah, I guess not. So
it's a little late for that. This is episode 19.
Man, that's awesome. We need to come up. When's our anniversary episode? When was the first one?
I'd have to look it up.
It's sometime in the summer.
It was June or something, wasn't it? Sometime in June, I think.
Maybe, yeah.
So.
And it was warm.
Yeah, because you had a fan on and it was making noise into the microphone.
That's right. Yeah,
I couldn't run the air conditioner, so it got warm in here.
Yeah. Well, no, there's been so much to talk about. Yeah, I needed it tonight, I tell you.
Oh, I'm telling you, me too. Being away from the internet for like a week and a half, and I'm not caught up on my Dungeons and Dragons articles. I'm not caught up on Twitter. I'm just, you know, at some point you reach the diminishing returns area and you just have to say, okay, I'm going to ignore that stuff and start from scratch, because otherwise you're just never going to catch up. So, you know, there's probably going to be some articles that I miss that I'll run into later and I'll be like, I don't remember reading this. How'd that happen? Because I read everything, you know?
Yeah. Oh, and I want to say, we didn't talk about the fourth core Saturday dungeon delve thing.
But I
had a chance to really read it yet, and I didn't want to talk about it until I've had a chance to read all the way through it.
I haven't had a chance to really look at it either.
Well, I honestly recommend having Dread Gazebo on.
Yeah.
And Save versus Death.
That's right. Yeah. I could remember the other. I knew there was another person collaborating with him. So, I think so. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, so I just, in case people are like, what? Why didn't you talk about that? That was big news. And I was like, I want to be able to read through it all the way first before
Iron Lich is also being thrown about as something we need to talk about, and I haven't read that yet either.
That is.
Oh, that's the first module in that fourth core. Yeah. Okay, my bad. Okay, sorry. Yeah, and
we now haven't read it.
Yeah, so listeners, tune in next time.
Yeah.
Totally.
Awesome.
All right.
All right. Well, so say goodbye, and I'll stop the recording.
Sounds great. Good night, everyone.
Night.
Good night.